From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR Sports Show, Only a Game. The story of Jackie Robinson breaking Major League Baseball's color line is well documented, but less well known is how the line had already been blurred. Ahead on Only a Game, in a special segment from NPR's Latino USA, we learn how Latin American players helped defeat segregation. Also ahead, one man's experiences at Pamplona's annual Running of the Bulls and my quest for a hole-in-one at a course that just seems to be handing them out. Also ahead, former Major Leaguer Greg with 1G Olson chats with former Major Leaguer Greg with 2Gs Olson for the first time in 25 years, and we catch up on the hilarity that ensues when their identities and their baseball cards are mistaken.
I just always want to know if you're getting as many cards of me as I'm getting of you.
I do. I get two letters, three letters a week with you in it. Depends on the mood I'm in. I'll put Ron Greg Olson, but sometimes I'll just throw them back.
Stay tuned. A history-making soccer celebration, the latest development in the case of a team name many view as racist, myself among them, and a question of progress for female football players, American football in that case. We'll get to all of those topics in three stories you should know, our look at the sports news you might have missed this week. My guests are USA Today columnist Nancy Armour, who joins me from WBEZ in Chicago, and Yahoo Sports contributor Danielle Elliott, who joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks.
Nancy, you covered the Women's World Cup for USA Today. Lucky you, as far as I'm concerned. But before we get to your topic, I'd like to ask you to describe the scene as those U.S. women overwhelmed Japan 5-2 in the final on Sunday in Vancouver.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that they scored four goals in the first 16 minutes. I've not seen anything like that before. At one point, I turned to one of my colleagues and said, is there a slaughter rule for the
Yeah,
World
right,
Cup
like
final?
When kids play, they stop
Exactly.
<it.
laughs> But it was really neat to see because, you know, this is the first title since 99. And for some women like Abby Wambach, who has done so much for the game and who has accomplished so much, the one thing that was missing on her resume was a World Cup title. And to see her celebrate was really neat. And just the joy and the spirit that the team has and the care that they have for each other. I mean, this really was a team effort.
The women's victory prompted New York City to throw a ticker tape parade in the Canyon of Heroes. This was the first ever such parade for a female sports team, which brings us to your topic for this week, right?
Yes. It's interesting because, as you said, it's the first ticker tape parade for a women's team. It's also the first time any female athlete has been honored since Carol Heiss in 1960. Mm. So we're talking 55 years. You know, the Yankees have gotten parades. The Giants have gotten parades. So this is really a monumental thing. The question is now, where does the women's game go from here? The league resumes play this weekend, the NWSL, and this is a pivotal season. The other two women's soccer leagues that there have been in the U.S. have folded after their third season, and this is the NWSL's third season. Mm-hmm. They are starting to see an uptick in tickets. Portland draws about 13,000 just on average, but, you know, the attendance for most NWSL games so far has been roughly 4,000, 3,500, something like that. So the organizers of the league, the players, are hoping that this will translate into people wanting to come out and see them play on a regular basis.
Danielle, Nancy said monumental regarding this parade in the Canyon of Heroes. Monumental seemed like the right adjective to you?
Absolutely. I was just down there for about an hour before coming in today, and I've been to those Yankees parades. I've been to the Giants parades. This was on par, if not much better. Everyone was just chanting USA. It was just, I mean, it was amazing.
Obviously, there is momentum, but really what's different? Hey, that was true back in 1999 as well. Is there really something that gives us some reason to be optimistic about this?
When you think back to 99, there wasn't a league at that point. I think the fact that there is a league already in place or currently in place gives them the potential to capitalize on the momentum, whereas it's a lot harder to do when, oh, hey, remember that team from 2 years ago or 3 years ago? Well, now they're playing again.
Moving along, my story involves the latest development regarding a lawsuit first filed 25 years ago. On Wednesday, Judge Gerald Bruce Lee affirmed that the NFL team in Washington, D.C. is not entitled to trademark their name because it's a racial slur, as defined, by the way, in the dictionary. Team officials have said they plan to appeal the latest ruling. Dave Zirin, the sports editor for The Nation, has compared them to, quote, half-mad generals braying orders on the battlefield long after the war has ended. I think he's got that about right. It's way past time for the Washington franchise to change their name. Danielle, I understand you were once a part of a similar debate.
I was. My junior year in high school, my school decided to change our mascot from the one that's currently used by the Washington football team. We ended up changing it to the Red Hawks.
Which side were you on at the time?
I was on the side that I don't like to admit I was on. I was in favor of keeping the name at that time. I'm happy to say that I've grown up and I am no longer on that side whatsoever.
Nancy, the legal process isn't over, but, you know, what do you think? What would it take for a name change to actually occur?
Well, I think some common sense on the part of Daniel Snyder, which seems to be in short supply when it comes to him. I was up in Minnesota last fall when the Washington team played the Vikings, and there's obviously a very large Native American population in Minnesota. If you talk to Native Americans, they say it's offensive. We don't get to tell them what they should be offended by and what they shouldn't be offended by.
Okay, Danielle, it's your turn. Tell us about your story that people might have missed.
A high school in Kansas City, Missouri, announced this week that a girl will be the starting quarterback on the freshman team. I think the most interesting part of the story was that the guys on her team said, "We don't understand why this is a story. She's played peewee with us. She's the best quarterback at our age. So why shouldn't she start?" Mm-hmm. I mean, we also have a girls' tackle football league that just started in Utah. There's so many questions around football for boys. The debate is out there. Should anybody be playing? Should we be adding leagues for girls? But in the middle of all of that, we have a girl starting at quarterback in Missouri.
Nancy, what do you think?
Well, the thing that jumps out to me is the fact that those girls' teammates were saying, "What's the big deal?" To them, it's unfathomable that you would think to separate them, that you would think that you wouldn't be able to play, which I think is a beautiful thing. And that's, you know, what we should be striving to achieve as a society.
I'm going to have to toss a little cold water on this one because I respond to this story a little bit the same way as I respond when people say to me, "What do you think about women boxing?" And I say, "I don't think women should be boxing, but I don't think men should be boxing either. Head injuries, the concussions, the lying by the NFL, the covering up of what was happening, even doctors misrepresenting what had happened to the players. We know from studies that girls and young women are even more prone to concussions than boys and men are. And I just really can't see anything too good coming from this, although I recognize mine may be an unpopular view. Danielle, you want to have the final word on that one?
People have come out saying girls are stronger than boys in middle school. And I mean, I spoke to a mother who had let her daughter play football throughout her childhood. And she said, "Yes, my daughter loves it. She's great at it. But when she's 13, she won't be playing anymore because that's when boys do start to just become that much bigger and stronger." So she wasn't even talking about concussions. She was just talking about other potential injuries because, you know, there's a lot more that can happen on a football field than a concussion.
My guests for Three Stories You Should Know have been Yahoo Sports contributor Danielle Elliott and USA Today columnist Nancy Armour. Thank you, Nancy, very much.
Thank you, Bill.
And Danielle, I really appreciate your presence. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
My conversation with Nancy Armour and Danielle Elliott was recorded on Friday afternoon. In the parking lot of the Neshawtuck Country Club in Concord, Massachusetts earlier this week, I could almost feel the magic. 10 people have registered holes in one on this golf course over the past 2 months. 4 of those aces came in the same week. I was at Neshawtuck to find out if it was my turn. Never mind that in my first misadventure in golf at the age of 7 or so, I'd broken the window in a groundskeeper's Jeep with a hooked 5-iron. Never mind that I hadn't hit a golf ball in earnest in 49 years. If the pin placement is correct and the hole is no more than 65 yards away, I have a shot. Joining me on the tee of the 121-yard 8th hole was the club's director of golf. Chris Carpenter's duty is to make life as enjoyable as it can be for the members at Neshawtuck and for a visiting radio host aspiring to join the swelling ranks of those who've recorded a hole-in-one there. Carpenter told me those ranks included an 11-year-old boy, a 79-year-old man, and a fellow who was playing in a strange tournament for which the flag sticks had been removed from the holes. Really, one guy got a hole-in-one here without being able to see where the hole was. My quest was delayed by the presence on the tee of a youngster with a club in his hands. His name is Ryan Vaughn, and he is 11.
You've heard the stories about how people keep making holes in one on this hole?
Yeah, it's been kind of crazy.
Yeah. So when you step up to the tee, are you thinking hole in one?
No, I'm just hoping to get it close.
And on this hole, if you get it close, it goes in.
Magic green.
I haven't hit a golf ball since 1966, so you can take me off the hook by hitting your shot in. We can pack up all this equipment and go home, all right?
I hope I can get there.
All right, kiddo. Go get him.
That looks pretty good. That looks excellent. Yeah, get in the hole. Come back.
That's Chris Carpenter gently urging Ryan Vaughn's drive to acquire more backspin and head for the hole. It stopped listening and quit 3 feet from the cup.
That's a gimme, kid.
That's a birdie.
That's a gimme.
Maybe the closest one we see today.
Then it was my turn. Well, that didn't go so well. That one was surprising in all the wrong ways.
I did find the water.
And you hit that a long way, too.
Is there some green there?
I could hardly wait to find out.
All right, that's well hit, but it's not in the right direction. Boink!
You're down to your last swing.
All right, and thank God for that. I've done everything except what we came out here to do.
The green was not quite large enough to accommodate my best shot, which was also my only acceptable shot. I was just 3 feet off the putting surface, though I was a very long putt from the hole. I didn't putt out. There'd have been no point. I'd come to the course to get a hole in one. I hadn't done it. Game over. In the company of Director of Golf Chris Carpenter, I retired to the club's dining room, where preparations for the next meal were in progress. Perhaps I should have been relieved. Tradition says anybody making a hole-in-one has to buy a round of drinks for everyone at the 19th hole. Let it be noted that the 11-year-old bought everybody Gatorade. Anyway, my inclination was to sulk, but Chris Carpenter was having none of that.
For not playing since 1966, I think it was a tremendous success. Expecting you to make a hole-in-one today was probably a little wishful thinking, but you gave it a heck of a good shot.
As for the magical run of holes-in-one, Carpenter, who has twice aced holes in his native Texas but has yet to do so at Neshawtuck, has no idea whether the next ace will occur soon.
I hope so. You never know until tomorrow, or maybe later today.
Unlike me, Chris Carpenter is an actual golfer. As such, he understands that delightful as the hole-in-one is, it's not really the point of the game.
You know, when it all comes to the end of the day, it's all how the scorecard totals up. I think my granddad told me ones and twos don't add up very fast, so the more of those you can have on your scorecard, the better it's going to be.
Sure, everybody knows it's the score over 18 holes that counts. But given the way the ball has been rolling so obediently into the hole on so many tee shots lately, who can doubt that every golfer at Neshawtuck is addressing drives with dreams of glory? This weekend, our colleagues at the NPR show Latino USA have a special episode all about baseball and the past, present, and future of the Latin American influence on the sport. We're pleased to bring you a segment from that program here on Only a Game. Latino USA producers Michael Simon Johnson and Daisy Rosario share the history of how Latin American players blurred the color line while Major League Baseball was still segregated.
We're standing right now on a map of the Caribbean.
So recently, I took a trip with another producer, Daisy Rosario.
An awesome trip to Cooperstown, New York, home of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. I've always wanted to go.
At the Hall of Fame Museum, we met John O'Dell, the curator of history and research.
He showed us a new exhibit called Viva Baseball, which chronicles the history of the game throughout Latin America.
Like we said, baseball's popularity in Latin America begins with Cuba.
The Cubans ended up taking baseball with them throughout the Caribbean, wherever they went.
To the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Mexico, Panama.
But now we get to the ugly history of Latino players coming here, to the U.S., So, while Cuba brought the sport to parts of Latin America, the United States was going through the process of taking this very popular leisurely activity and turning it into a business.
Like much of American life at the time, the game is segregated.
We're talking about baseball's infamous color line.
The invisible line that divided the white major leagues from the Negro leagues.
People thought that white audiences would never accept a black player, so no matter how talented they might be, black players weren't allowed on white teams.
I reached out to Adrian Burgos, a professor at the University of Illinois who's written a number of books on the history of baseball.
Baseball's color line operated from 1889 to 1946.
And before Jackie Robinson famously broke the color line,
we had 53 Latin American and U.S.-born Latinos that participated in the major leagues.
A small number of Latinos were bending it.
There was the split of if you were a darker-skinned Latin player, you wouldn't be signed by a major league team. You'd be signed by a Negro Leagues team. If you were lighter-skinned, you'd be signed by a major league team.
Just like today, Latinos 100 years ago came in every shade. So this process of being split up was a very strange experience for the Latin American players.
The professional baseball in Latin America was always integrated. They did not have a color line.
Many Latin American players were coming to the U.S., and the vast majority were Afro-Latinos, so they played in the Negro Leagues.
We can say about 10 to 15% of the Negro Leagues were Latino players.
And it went the other way, too. The African-American players who weren't allowed in the majors would often go to foreign leagues in the offseason, to Mexico or Cuba, and play in integrated leagues with players of all different colors, something they couldn't do in their own country.
Yeah, it's a lot like maybe the history you've heard about where black American jazz musicians went to Paris.
So the light-skinned Latin American players obviously had it much easier once they came here, although they had to go through the unusual process of being racialized. Because they were, say, Cuban, the fear was that even if they didn't look black, they might still have African blood in them, and that just wouldn't do. But talent was talent, so managers who wanted to acquire these players simply changed the language around how the players were presented.
They were presented to the baseball public as, he's not black, he's Cuban. He's not black, he's Puerto Rican.
Early on, both players and managers recognized how flexible the color line was when it came to Latinos, and they tried their best to take advantage of it. Take the New York Cuban Giants, a team made up entirely of African Americans who, legend has it, would speak gibberish to each other on the field in the hopes of convincing crowds that they weren't black, but rather Cuban.
Then there's the story of the manager who plotted to send black players down to Cuba, have them learn Spanish, and then bring them back up and try to pass them off as authentically Latino. Stories like these were actually a big part of the Viva Baseball exhibit at the Hall of Fame.
Let me show you real quickly a document that is one of my favorites here in the entire museum.
John O'Dell told us about two talented Cuban pitchers, Rafael Almeida and Armando Marsans, who were being eyed by the Cincinnati Reds in 1910. The question, of course, was,
are these guys dark Latin players or are they white Latin players? The Cincinnati Reds sent a scout down to Cuba, and here's what he said.
John read to us from a scan of the original document.
I know personally both parents of our great ball players, Marsans and Almeida, and guarantee that none of them have any other but pure Caucasian blood in their veins. Their claims to the members of the white race is as good as yours and mine. Signed, Victor Munoz.
Oh, my God.
It's just so open.
It's so official. It's so part of the business, the system of it.
This, argues Adrian Burgos, is where it all comes back to money. Because those two players, whose Caucasian blood was verified, Marsans and Almeida, once they had played a few seasons with Cincinnati, they started asking for higher pay.
One of the team officials of the Cincinnati Reds, while this contract holdout is taking place, informs the press that we did not hire a pair of bronze-skinned islanders to pay them Honus Wagner money.
Translation, white money. Honus Wagner was a major league superstar in his day.
The essence of that statement was they'd want that talent, but they don't necessarily want to pay it the equivalent of what the white American players were receiving.
Greg Olson, how are you?
Good, Greg. How are you?
25 years ago at the 1990 Major League Baseball All-Star Game, a catcher from the National League and a pitcher from the American League each made their first and only All-Star Game appearances. That was when catcher Greg, with one G at the end, Olson, first encountered pitcher Greg, with two G's at the end, Olson. Though their lives have been entangled in various ways, they hadn't spoken to each other since 1990, until I got both of them on the line earlier this week.
Well, it's been a long time since we talked. I mean, it's amazing that we really didn't cross paths because there's no interleague play, but this will be kind of fun.
Yeah, it should be. It should be. Yeah, we had a couple minutes at the All-Star game, and that was about the five-minute talk that we had.
At the beginning of the 1990 season, Greg Olson, the catcher, 30 years old, was in his eighth full season in the minor leagues. He was thinking about leaving the game, but a series of unlikely retirements and injuries led the Atlanta Braves to call him up, and his lucky streak continued on the field.
There was a young pitcher some people may know named Tommy Glavine, who ended up being pretty doggone good. Well, I caught him in Cincinnati one Sunday, and we won the game. Tommy wanted me to catch the next time because he liked the unique way I got low. So I caught the next game, went 3-for-5. We won again. And then the next thing you know, I was platooning with Ernie Witt. 2 days later, Ernie Witt broke his thumb, and I went from never playing to being the first-string catcher. And, you know, as you know, in All-Star games, you have to have at least one representative. And I will be honest, the Atlanta Braves in 1990 weren't very good.
Like Greg with 1G, Greg Olson, the pitcher, in his second season of what would be a 14-year career in the majors, was humbled when he entered the clubhouse for the All-Star game at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, you just walk in and you're just starstruck. I was in my second year, and, you know, I'm locked her next to Boggs, I'm locked her next to McGuire. I don't think I got out of my chair. You know, I wanted to stay out of everybody's way, and I don't know what the heck I'm doing here, but this is great.
Great, until various people began confusing Greg Olson with Greg Olson. Here's Greg with 2 G's again.
I remember getting to the hotel, and they had everything mixed up. I don't know if I got your room, you got mine. I know I got your laundry, you got mine. I got a couple of your messages on the voicemail. Yeah, it was kind of a pain.
Then ESPN stepped in.
ESPN had him on the set first, and then they wanted me to come walking in the middle of it. Did something like, I'm supposed to do an interview here. I'm Greg Olson. Took a couple pictures of the Olson and Olson jerseys, and that was about it.
Since they hadn't spoken in 25 years, I decided to ask Greg with 1G if there was anything he wanted to ask the Greg with 2 G's.
Do you receive my cards likewise, or have you kept your address out of the card collector's hands? Because I just always want to know if you're getting as many cards of me as I'm getting of you.
Yes, I do. I get, give or take, probably 3 letters a week with you in it. It depends on the mood I'm in. I'll put Ron Greg Olson, but sometimes I'll just throw them back.
I think you guys should both just sign them. Come on, make the kids happy.
Well, I need to see his signature first, you know, just to get a decent idea on it. I had a pretty good Cal Ripken for a while. So, yeah, I can do a signature if needed.
Request to sign cards might be a kick, but Greg, with 1G, was more excited to receive a gratifying, albeit misdirected, invitation.
I got a letter from Roger Clemens saying, come on down. I can't wait to see you. Come down and play my golf tournament. You know, love to have you. You just let me know where you want to stay, blah, blah, blah. And give me a call if you want. Here's my cell number. So I call up and I said, Roger, I think you probably want this to go to the other Greg Olson, but I'd love to come to your golf tournament. He laughed.
Did you get to go?
I didn't go, no.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, I got to go. One time only. I don't know if I did something wrong.
The stories the Olsons had to tell were fun, and did I mention they both share the same middle name, which is William, with 2 L's? Anyway, what was most gratifying about reconnecting Greg with 1G to Greg with 2 G's was the sense the connection might continue.
1G, it was a pleasure talking to you, and have to find you on the internet and trade info.
Well, trade trading cards, too, for goodness sake. Thanks, fellas. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, 2G.
All right, 1G, take care.
The field game of hurling looks a bit like a combination of field hockey, lacrosse, and baseball. Players with wooden sticks, called hurleys, try to knock a ball through a goal. It's fast, rough, and a proud Irish tradition. Producer Alex Ward followed the sport to an unlikely place.
It'd be hard to guess the number of times I've explained what hurling is to my family and friends. They'll ask, oh, is that where you throw the logs across the field? Or, that's where you slide the things down the ice, like a big shuffleboard, right? I don't blame people for not knowing. Here in the United States, it's obscure, which is why it's so unusual that a game would be going on here. I'm at the McLaren Youth Correctional Facility, just outside of Woodburn, Oregon. A concrete path winds past brick housing units and school buildings towards the athletic fields. If it weren't for the high, inward-curved fences and security lights around the perimeter, it looked like a modest college campus.
Hit it! You can hit it! Let's go!
I came here with the Willamette Hurling Club, which I helped start almost 5 years ago. We're joined by the Columbia Red Branch, another team based in Portland. Willamette wears navy blue and gold jerseys. Columbia wears bright red. And then there's a dozen or so inmates, dressed in white and gray t-shirts with shorts or sweatpants. They're finishing up some basic drills right now, learning how to pick the ball up with a hurley. Now, if you've ever seen a hurley, which looks like a big wooden axe, this whole thing might seem like a bad idea.
There's that split second in your mind of what the hell are they going to do? You know, are they going to hit each other? Is there some bad blood between them?
That's Stephen Power. He plays for the Columbia Red Branch. The two clubs were invited here today by the Celtic Studies Group, one of many cultural study programs within McLaren. It's the second time we've been here, but it's the first time they've let the residents play alongside us in the game.
You know, of course, there's a little bit of nervousness of, you know, how will they react to the sport? It is a very aggressive sport. But their passion and their focus on playing, beating each other, beating us, I really, really was very surprised and very appreciative of just the approach they took. They had all the right questions. They wanted to play the sport fairly, but aggressively.
Right, four games, 20 seconds. Try and get as many people.
Nice. To make things even, the players are mixed in with the residents for the game. Inmate Kyle Mahan came off the field at halftime, sweaty and tired, but looking pumped up.
It's fun, man. I want to get better at it. It'd be more fun, but I cracked that one. I thought it was going to go in.
Kyle missed out the last time our club came to McLaren, so he was all the more eager to play today. I knew I had to talk to Kyle. His tattoos gave him away. I spotted a shamrock on his leg, and then four Celtic knots covering his shoulder. Except his Celtic knots have skulls in the middle of them.
They're my faith, you know, but everybody's got some demons inside of them, you know, even hidden, you know, inside. It's definitely my favorite tattoo. As far as culture goes, you know, like when I was growing up, I was told, you know, you're Irish and, you know, fight this dude and drink this much alcohol and, like, I don't know, I kind of got in trouble a lot in school and I just kind of was all over the place, you know?
Kyle is like a lot of the guys I met in here. Made some bad choices as a teenager at the wrong place at the wrong time. But the administrators here say that's the goal of the cultural programs at McLaren, to give them time and opportunities to grow up. Plus, a game like hurling is perfect for getting some aggression out.
I feel like I got a little bit used to it. I got hit in the arm and took a stick to the face, but I had a helmet on, so nothing happened. But that was a pretty fun sport, man. You know, I grew up playing football and wrestling, and I never really did anything like that.
Often when I'm talking to a potential recruit for the hurling team, they'll say, I'm not really Irish. Is that a problem? Trust me, you don't have to be Irish to play hurling and love it. The game here is the most diverse I've ever seen. Most of these guys aren't from Irish descent. According to Stephen, if you know what hurling is and you've played it, that goes a long way back home in Ireland.
It doesn't matter if you're Jewish Irish, African American Irish, whatever Irish you are, you pick up a hurley, you're Irish. It doesn't matter what you are. You would automatically become more Irish and get more, as you'd call in the US, street cred. Pretty quick, the street cred would be there in the pubs.
When I first heard about going to a youth correctional facility, I thought it'd be a great thing for the hurling team to do as a bonding trip or just something to do out of the ordinary. But after seeing how much Kyle and the rest of the guys engaged with the sport, it got me thinking about how much I depend on hurling and other sports to keep me grounded and active. When I talked with Stephen about this after the game, he said he felt the same way.
It's been good for me, you know, and I'm, you know, a middle-aged man. I think it'd be really, really good for some of these guys to get a little bit of structure in their lives and something to really focus on.
I wonder if that's the very thing some of these guys inside didn't have growing up. Something that gives you the same adrenaline you get doing something you shouldn't be doing. Maybe a community-oriented sport like hurling is the perfect vehicle to bring somebody back out of prison and into society again. You know, now that I mention it, it's not a bad way to maintain a steady stream of young, athletic recruits. So Kyle, and all the rest of the guys in there, hit us up when you get out. There's always room on the team. And we could use a few bruisers. For Only a Game, I'm Alex Ward.
Coming up on Only a Game, an American makes his case for running with the Bulls in Pamplona, and he should know. He's done it more than 70 times. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I'm happy for him, but that strikes me as one of the right up there with living with the Grizzly Bears. That strikes me as really a dangerous way to live your life.
Yeah, I can't argue that it's not dangerous. Sports on Earth presented their inaugural This Week's Greatest Athlete Award to Carly Lloyd, who had three goals against Japan in the Women's World Cup final on Sunday evening. Good choice?
Yeah, I mean, if we're doing this every week, absolutely. Nobody had a better week than Carly Lloyd did. I kept looking down during that game, and every time I looked up, the Americans had scored again. It was strange. I'm not used to that in a soccer game.
No, it's not usually a danger with soccer. FIFA brought the hammer down on one of the association's former executives this week. Chuck Blazer, whose testimony helped the U.S. indict a passel of FIFA's finest, has been banned for life from taking part in any aspect of soccer. Gee, FIFA, talk about a sore loser.
I mean, this is a scapegoat who, by the way, actually looks like a scapegoat.
An escape goat.
Why are they being mean to Santa Claus, I thought. Yeah. But I guarantee you this is the first of many bans for life.
NBA free agent DeAndre Jordan had a verbal agreement to sign a maximum deal with the Dallas Mavericks. He reneged on that deal and re-signed with the LA Clippers. Mavericks forward Chandler Parsons accused Jordan of being scared. Scared of what, exactly?
I love this story because it's actually human drama. The NBA has this very weird thing in its collective bargaining agreement where you can agree to a deal, but you have an 8-day window on which you can change your mind.
Mm-hmm.
This guy took advantage of the 8-day window to change his mind. I would offer Mark Cuban the great advice that the great basketball coach, the late Abe Lemons, once gave me. Verbal commitments aren't worth the paper they're printed on.
Do you have any idea what the Clippers did to win Jordan?
They locked him in his house until they wouldn't let him go until he re-signed.
That worked. Good. Okay.
But there was like tweeting and emoji flying and Paul Pierce trying to be a man of trying to be a child of the cyber age that went horribly wrong. It was great.
On Wednesday, the Spurs announced that Manu Ginobili would not be relocating after 13 years in San Antonio. I'm guessing the signing of LaMarcus Aldridge and the re-signing of Kawhi Leonard helped make that decision.
Boy, the Spurs just don't make mistakes. It's very, very strange. They get the one free agent they want. They don't lose any pieces that they want to keep. And they convince Manu Ginobili to come back because of what the front office has already done.
Charlie, Kenny Stabler passed away on Wednesday. The former Raiders quarterback played 15 seasons. He passed for over 27,000 yards. He was a four-time Pro Bowler and led the Raiders to a Super Bowl win back in 1977. Any connections with the Snake?
No, just to watch him play the game, he was an extraordinary passer, a much better pure passer than Joe Namath was, to name another guy from the University of Alabama. And kudos to Ken Stabler and his family. They have donated his brain and spinal cord to the Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center right down the street here at BU and to Ann McKee's ongoing study to what football does to people. So good on him.
The MLB All-Star Game will take place Tuesday in Cincinnati, and Commissioner Rob Manfred has given Pete Rose permission to be on the field as part of a promotion that honors the four players fans think had the biggest impact on each of the league's 30 teams. Rose is hoping it doesn't end there.
No, he's wide open to almost anything, he says. Of course, there was the recent revelation of the file that somehow got leaked from the original investigation that showed he actually did bet on baseball while he was playing. I don't know. I mean, it's Cincinnati. There's absolutely no reason for Pete Rose not to be there. Who knows where this will lead?
Last week, we discussed a sandwich at a Long Island deli named for Mets pitcher Steven Matz, who visited the deli and failed to order the sandwich that was named after him. This week, Matz is in the news because a muscle tear will keep him off the mound for about 3 weeks. Do you suppose there's any connection between
maybe
them?
Well, now he can go try the sandwich.
Theorists.
Now he can go try the sandwich.
That's
the thing. He's got some idle time.
Eat whatever he wants.
Absolutely.
Yeah. After losing to Serena Williams at Wimbledon on Tuesday, Victoria Azarenka was asked by reporters about the loud noises during the match as she and her opponent hit the ball. She was outraged. She expressed dismay over the question. She said, "Rafael Nadal grunts more loudly." Is there a gender double standard when it comes to tennis grunting?
There probably is. I don't care. Victoria Azarenka did nothing but prove that she's nothing but another entitled tennis twit.
You know, that last one sounded like the beginning of a James Brown song.
Good God.
Good God.
Take it to the bridge.
And finally, Charlie, Jaguar, a major sponsor of Wimbledon, surprised two Wimbledon fans with a free ride to a match. The fans were startled to discover they were familiar with the driver.
Hey, how you guys doing?
I'm very well.
What's going on?
We're good.
I hear it's
how are you?
Tom and
Tom. Not Tom. Yeah, Nick. Nice to meet you. And Nick.
All right.
Nice to meet you.
I wonder if you hopped into a cab and the driver turned out to be John McEnroe, what would you say to him?
I'd say, hello, John, and sit back quietly and hope to God that no cab cut him off while he was driving. You cannot be serious!
Yeah, I was going to say, you wouldn't be tempted to say you cannot be serious, or are you incompetent, or something along those lines? Just out of curiosity, who would be your first choice if you could be driven somewhere, anywhere, by an athlete-turned-chauffeur?
I think it would probably be Bill Lee, because I can picture myself on a boat on a river with Tangerine Dreams and Marmalades guys. Mm.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I knew you were going to do that again. Baseball is about numbers, and pitcher Jose Fernandez has a dandy one going. Fernandez began his major league career with the Miami Marlins in 2013, and he was Rookie of the Year that season. His career was derailed temporarily by an injury and surgery, but overall he has won his first 14 decisions in Miami, thus tying the modern record for most consecutive home victories by a starter to begin a career. His earned run average in Miami is 1.17. He probably wishes he could arrange to bring his fans along when the Marlins travel, since on the road he's 4-8 with an ERA of 3.93. Sometimes I look in the stands and see the kids laughing and saying my name, and it's really special, Fernandez recently told Fox Sports. Knowing everything I've been through, I really appreciate it. Certainly there are some significant numbers in everything Fernandez has been through. He and his mother tried unsuccessfully to defect from Cuba three times, beginning when Fernandez was a small child. The three failed defections were each followed by prison terms where he was charged with being a traitor. Fernandez and his mother succeeded in their fourth attempt, but that wasn't easy. He had to dive off the boat that was carrying them to Florida in order to rescue his mother, who had fallen overboard. The team employing Jose Fernandez is not doing so well in the numbers department. The Marlins are well under 500, fourth in the five-team National League East. They are third from the bottom of the list of all major league teams in home attendance, but it's perhaps fair to assume they'd be last if they weren't sending Jose Fernandez to the mound as often as they can. His appearances have drawn crowds which have been conservatively characterized as larger than normal, which can't have been surprising, given the way Fernandez has pitched and what he's gone through just to reach the mound. In Bulls Before Breakfast, Peter Milligan says of running with the Bulls in Pamplona, "This isn't some rite of passage to manhood. It isn't a contest to see who can act like a jerk." So what is it exactly? What motivates people to embrace the risks of running with the Bulls year after year? Because Peter Milligan has been doing it for 12 years, and he's in Pamplona right now doing it again. Peter Milligan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Let's start with an explanation of how it is that you have run with the Bulls as often as you have. Each trip to the Fiesta in Pamplona gives you not just one, but half a dozen runs, right?
Yes, they run every day from July 7th through July 14th, as they've done now for hundreds of years.
For those of us who have never run with the Bulls, could you please describe what the general scene is like during the festival in Pamplona?
Well, during the Fiesta, it's a small city, which is the capital of Navarra. It's a university town, and it has a pretty active nightlife. It's a happening town, but during the Fiesta, it swells to about 1 million to 1.5 million people, more than it normally holds. It's packed to the gills. Every morning at 8 a.m., a couple thousand of those people run with the Bulls on the cobblestone streets.
I'm not sure we have time for a complete catalog of all the injuries you've suffered running with the Bulls, but give us the short list.
Well, I've broken my ankle, a compound fracture with two bones sticking out the side. I've broken both of my elbows. I have cracked some ribs. I've been kicked in the head. The Bulls have stepped on my back. They have very sharp hooves, and it sliced me open. I haven't yet had the privilege of tasting the horn, and hopefully I will be able to avoid that for the rest of my life.
most people are bound to think the greatest danger that runners face is being gored by a bull, but it doesn't sound as if that's necessarily true.
Well, there's only six bulls, but there's thousands of runners. Most people, it's their first time. There's a lot of grabbing and pushing and panic in the street when the bulls first appear. Everybody's a tough guy until the horns show up, and then natural panic takes over. We've been pulled down. This morning when we ran, close to 25 to 30 people laid their hands on me. No ill intention. It's just a natural reaction to the fear that takes on when the bulls show up. And they're not looking to take one person. It's not a lion or a great white looking for dinner and satisfied with one. If they have the intention of going after runners, they are not going to stop at the first one they get. They'll just go until they lose interest.
Despite the obvious dangers that you've described, you maintain that running with the bulls, and I'm quoting now, is not about machismo. Help me out here, because it certainly sounds as if that's exactly what it's about.
Well, the first time we came here, it was that. It's a celebrated Hemingway American feeling. We're macho guys, and we thought we're tough guys, and we'd come over here and conquer this. But as we got to know the locals better, and as we got to be more introduced to the hundreds of years of tradition, we learned that you're not trying to show off. You're not trying to appear to be the toughest, the fastest, the strongest out there. It's the bull's last day on earth. They're running to the bull ring, where later in the afternoon they will face the Spanish matadors. So you are running with them. You're not running against them. You're joining the herd. And there's a real sense of brotherhood and tradition to it. And frankly, we find a sense of joy in throwing our head back and running as fast as we can. And for at least a metaphysical second, getting as close to the bulls and joining their herd out there in the morning.
Do you ever give the bull's role in the fiesta any thought, especially considering what happens to them at the end of the day?
They are the central focus. The entire fiesta here is really a religious fiesta. They are they're recognizing the patron saint of Pamplona, which is San Fermín, and part of that is the running of the bulls, and it's been that way for not the entire life of the fiesta, but for a very long time. There's a sense of reverence for the bulls. They live better than any captured animal in the world up until their death. Their death is difficult. It's bloody, it's barbaric, and anybody that doesn't want to go and see that, I completely understand.
Peter, here's one reason why I'm not sure I understand what you're up to. As you have put it, and I'm quoting now, bulls will kill you and stomp on your lifeless body and brag about it with friends later. Has it not occurred to you that there may be other arenas wherein you can be, as you put it, bold, daring, purposeful, steady, proud, mighty, righteous, triumphant, spirited?
Well, yeah, I mean, we can climb mountains, we can go hiking, we can sail ships, you know, we can go out and build cabins in the woods. There's all kinds of activities. This one's here. It's not going away. And we found a life here. There's not a morning when we're out there when we do not take it very seriously. We have seen people maimed. We've seen people killed. There's no happiness there. There's no joy there. It's a horrible, horrible thing. We take the greatest possible care that we can and still get out there and do what we came here for.
Do you have a favorite story that stands out above all the rest?
My favorite story is from 2005, when we really still didn't know what we were doing. We were still pretty much cowering in fear behind the crowds and maybe hiding in a doorway or climbing up on a drain pipe to get away from the runners. And a lone bull, which the Spanish call a suelto, turned around from the running and decided to come back and investigate me and another runner who I didn't know at the time but has become a lifelong friend. His name is Xavier. And he fell, and the bull went after him, and I jumped up on a fence. The bull lost interest in Xavier and stood there. It felt to me like it was 10 minutes where he sat there and stared at me. Everybody says it was just a couple of seconds. And there are cowboys, the people from the ranches that help guide the bulls. They're called pastores. And the pastore cracked his willow stick against the concrete, and then the bull got back to running. The photograph of me hanging from the fence with the bull ended up on a tourist magnet here in Pamplona. and I was hooked.
In the final chapter of the book, you ask, perhaps rhetorically, why don't most Americans understand why this is so important to us? Have you ever come up with an answer?
I think that it starts with a misunderstanding of Hemingway, that it's all about being macho and showing off. And I think probably, you know, Hemingway's family still comes here as two of his grandsons and one of his great-grandchildren we've become really good friends with. And we've had the opportunity to discuss this with them, that there's just the sense of that all Hemingway was about was grandiose macho celebrations. And I think he was probably a little bit more complicated than that. And they just don't look into it any more than it being a bucket list item. And here, it's much more than that. It's a way of life. It's not something to come and do once and check it off your list. Everybody's welcome to come and do it. It's one of the last democratic things in the world. There's no sign up. There's no filing fee. There's no permission slip. There's no insurance waiver. You just, if you're over 18 and somewhat sober, you're welcome in the street.
Peter Milligan's new book is titled Bulls Before Breakfast, Running with the Bulls and Celebrating Fiesta de San Fermín in Pamplona, Spain, where he is currently running with the Bulls once again. Peter, thank you very much for speaking with me, and good luck.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.